Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It is Monday with the Mayor, Boston Mayor Michelle Wu, joining us to take our questions and yours. Do you have questions about the one-week extension on the vaccine mandate for city employees? Is there something you want to know about affordable housing, transit, safety during these cold winter months? A question about the search process for a new police commissioner? Give us and Mayor Wu a call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. Boston Mayor Michelle Wu, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Tiziana. Always great to be with you.
Great to have you. I want to start with a belated happy birthday. You turned 37 a little more than a week ago.
Thank you very much.
Did you get to celebrate?
We went out to Dumpling Kingdom, and I stuffed my face with three different kinds of dumplings in Alston. It was lovely.
Excellent. You know, you are now 10 weeks in, roughly, as mayor. Protests against your COVID measures have been bruising. We have protesters downstairs out in front of the building, 15 or 20 of them right now, as I am speaking with you. I wonder, any little corner in these 10 weeks of unexpected joy you've come across in your role?
Oh, there's been so much. Let's see. I have treasured the chances to be out and about. And there's been moments where people have sort of pulled over their cars or waved me down to say that they feel so much hope in the city and they couldn't believe that everything that we'd been talking about on the campaign trail is now has a chance to become reality. It's been wonderful to see as we're building out our team within City Hall, just how much can be done, how quickly, and the amazing teamwork that led to a very different approach to our crises of homelessness, mental health, and substance use, and the results we've already seen just with the placement of over 150 residents, longtime residents of the encampments at Mass and Cass, now in supportive housing and able to say that the city's taken a big step towards really addressing these crises. And every day I get to see the impact of city government out and about. So it's been extremely joyful all around.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. Let's jump into the impact of city government. Obviously, the big news today is the delayed employee vaccination mandate, delaying it for a week. You said this morning that you're almost there with city employees, but you also addressed pushback from unions who said your move to remove the testing option violated collective bargaining. I could imagine one of two reasons here, Mayor Wu, to postpone another week. One, you're almost there, and if you wait, you might be able to really minimize the number of employees that you have to suspend or put on leave for lack of compliance. Two, such strong pushback from the unions that you want to get as far as you can in working with the unions prior to having it go into effect. Are either of those the reason that you are doing it? And if not, why the delay for an additional week?
Yep, I think it's actually both. That one, we did see tremendous progress in boosting our vaccination rate and closing those gaps. Even over the last week, we've now had more than 1,600 additional city workers get vaccinated since we announced that this policy would be going into effect a couple weeks ago. And we've hosted city worker-specific vaccine clinics all through last week. We're hosting another set this week, and those have really helped to close some of the gaps. And then even over the weekend, we were having some very long and involved but productive conversations with city unions. And so I don't take this lightly, the fact that even in the middle of a crisis, even though this is a clear action to protect public health and public safety during a pandemic, it is still very impactful for individual city workers and for someone to go on unpaid leave or progress even further into potentially losing their job is significant. The goal of this was not to punish anyone for how they might feel about vaccination, but to ensure that our city workers are safe and that our any residents interacting with our city workforce is safe. So we're taking every possible step. And this week, we hope to see some big steps forward in terms of progress with some of our unions, as well as continuing to close those gaps. We're almost there, 94% vaccinated across the entire city workforce now.
So let's stay with that for a minute. We had a tweet question come in from at POTUS Dana that said, would you be so kind to ask the mayor if her decision for vaccine mandates were discussed with public employees prior to finalizing her decision? And if not, how does she see herself rebuilding relationships with unions and traditional bargaining? And it's that rebuilding, you know, that mentioned the protesters downstairs whose signs say "Woo burns firefighters." Clearly, there is a breach of goodwill with the unions here, Mayor Wu. What do you do with and about that?
Well, you know, it's painful to see that there's still such deep emotion. And honestly, I see so much of this connected to campaigns of misinformation that are out there about how safe the vaccines are and questions about whether this is necessary or even helpful in the course of the pandemic and during Omicron. And it's our job in leadership at the city level to do everything that we can to move Boston forward and to get us out of this pandemic. So this is a necessary step. Now, the job of our municipal unions is to advocate for each and every one of their members. I respect that, and I honor the processes and the role that our union leadership plays in ensuring that all of our workers have a voice at the table, every single one of our workers. The vast majority of our workforce is vaccinated, right? So we're at 95% vaccination for Boston Police, 91% vaccination for Boston Fire, and we are seeing those gaps continue to close. So we will be moving forward with this policy. We're continuing to engage with our city municipal unions as well as our individual city workers. This is something that is necessary, but we're going to do it as much as we can in partnership or really addressing the individual impacts on our workers and their families.
So I am going to go to the phones in a few minutes. I'm going to do a little more with you on COVID and vaccinations, et cetera. Most of the calls are in other areas, which is great, but I want to stay on this and finish a little bit more conversation here. We are a week into requiring proof of vaccination at restaurants, entertainment venues, gyms. From your perspective, how is that going? How strong is compliance? Etc.
The city policy around showing proof of vaccination for certain businesses where there's indoor activities that are higher risk or where people are more likely to be unmasked is going very, very well. It's been a very smooth implementation, and our business owners have been amazing. I know they've been under such stress and challenge during the pandemic. I'm hoping that as we take actions to make Boston even safer and to drive up our vaccination rate and drive down our COVID positivity rate, that this will be felt in our local economy as well.
Have you talked to any specific business owners over the last week, you know, one way or the other, whether, you know, personally, somebody who likes that you're doing this or someone who doesn't?
Yes, I've been at a couple businesses myself and have had to show my proof of vaccination as well. You know, I've heard that adding one more thing to the list is just one more thing when there are so many things that are on the shoulders of our business owners. In some cases, I've heard that business has been very busy since the policy went into place, whether it's because case counts are coming down anyway or because people feel more comfortable coming out with this policy in place. And I've heard from many constituents all across the city who are sometimes tweeting at me or sharing their stories that they've now felt comfortable taking their elderly parent to lunch or getting a group dinner with friends now that this is there. So we hope that that will continue to be the case and everyone goes out and supports our local businesses.
Last time you were with us was a couple of days before this requirement went into effect. And one of the things that stuck with me, Mayor Wu, about that conversation, I asked you, excuse me, given your experience with some very virulent pushback about this, about that frontline hospitality worker, that server or restaurant manager who essentially is responsible for enforcement. And you talked about how important it is that it be a citywide requirement so that people understand it doesn't come from the individual business. I was really struck by some reporting from Joe Battenfeld in the Boston Herald last week about a worker at Regina Pizzeria in the North End who got punched in the face by an angry, unvaccinated customer. We know some of that's going to happen. Now, I also know there's lots of places where that's not happening. But I want to give you a chance to react to that. You know, that is that scary, deep, personal experience that happens when you're doing your job and you get caught in the middle of this. And so both, any chance you've spoken to anyone who's had that experience or maybe that manager, and what is your response to that?
Yep, I've had a couple conversations with folks about different incidents that we saw. The situation at this particular restaurant, I think, was actually about masks and not about the vaccination requirement at all. Although, you know, certainly connected to frustration around the pandemic and pandemic protections in general. And then I had visited Penguin Pizza the other day where they were subject to some targeted harassment around resisting the vaccination requirement as well. And I think in a lot of cases, we see how much the stress of the pandemic is really affecting all of our day-to-day interactions with people, the toll that it's taken on our own individual health and well-being and mental health. You can see play out in the calls that we're getting from Boston police, from people in crisis, to the situation where school nurses across our schools are saying that our young people are under tremendous stress. There is a whole pandemic after the pandemic of really us needing to pay attention to mental health and invest in the resources for people to feel supported and safe and connected to community again. So that is a larger issue that we'll continue to support individual business owners who might have challenges or anyone else who needs backup or to be safe. But there's a larger conversation here about how we heal and reconnect as a community.
Let's go to the phones, Mayor Wu, 1-800-423-8255 to ask your questions on Monday with the Mayor. We've got Deborah on the line in Alston. Deborah, go ahead.
Hi, Mayor Wu. This is Phoebe calling. You know, I'm calling because I'm so concerned about the condition of Boston public schools, especially in Alston, Brighton. I know that you know what state Brighton High is in and that Jackson Man is going to have to be torn down. But meanwhile, in the last 10 years, BPS has been assessed almost $2 billion for charter schools, but the state has not met its obligation to reimburse the city for part of that money. So how are we going to get those funds to protect our kids?
Go ahead, Mary Lou.
Thank you so much, DB, for calling in and for all that you are thinking about and leading on in terms of the neighborhood and the city. This is what keeps me up at night, thinking about how much our school communities have gone through in the pandemic and how much we need to really stabilize at the classroom and school and district level. The toll of COVID-19. So we are both reacting immediately to the needs around maintaining safety in our classrooms and ensuring that as the pandemic continues on, there are ways for our young people to continue learning and being in community, but also that bigger picture, longer term of how do we ensure that all of our facilities are healthy, sustainable, inspiring places to learn? How do we ensure that the loss that our students have felt and the gaps that we've seen deepen during the pandemic that we're really addressing with social and emotional supports and academic supports everywhere. So this is somewhere where I'm leaning in a lot. And you're right that we need a whole lot of attention, resources, and energy directed at our Boston Public Schools and our young people overall.
And do you see a responsive partner in the state?
Well, the question that DB brought up was around charter school reimbursements and the funding and the resources that are needed. We are in a moment right now where, at least for the time being, there's still funds available from the federal government for our recovery, as well as from the state. We need to make good use of those funds, and we are putting in place some of the processes that will determine our budget leading into this next school year and this next fiscal year for the city. So, you know, we could always use more support from the state and more investment. For now, in the moment, the question is, how do we really support the organization, the capacity, and make sure that everyone who's been under such strain in terms of our school staff get the resources that they need to be able to do a good job.
So your focus right now is on pandemic relief money, is what you're saying.
That's right.
Okay,
yes.
Let's grab one more call here, 800-423-8255. Before the break, we've got Kurt on the line in Jamaica Plain. Kurt, go ahead.
Hi, Mayor Wu. I just wanted to ask if you have any update you can share with us about where things are with your administration moving ahead with the Green New Deal plan. It's so exciting to have that shared with us, you know, in the lead up to the election, and just love to know if there's anything you can share with us about where that's at.
Go ahead.
Thank you so much, Kurt. I am. This is an area where I'm really, really excited for Boston to lead. We just recently put out our job posting. We're hiring right now, and we'll be doing a search for a senior advisor, kind of a czar, to be really moving forward the Green New Deal among all of our city cabinets and departments. And we continue to work closely with our environment and energy, environment and open space cabinet and streets cabinet and our Office of Housing and schools to find individual steps that we are taking, whether it's around electrification or increasing the number of electric vehicle charging stations that are available, or moves around increasing access to fare free public transportation, which we hope to see fully moving forward on the 3 bus lines next month, and other initiatives around the tree plan and everything else that we had put forward in the Green New Deal. So much more progress to come, but we're looking to find someone who will be leading and coordinating those efforts from within.
It is Monday with the mayor, Boston Mayor Michelle Wu, still with us answering our questions and yours. Call with your question. Do you want to know more about schools, about cold weather, safety and housing security, transit, free buses, what we need from our next police commissioner? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to ask your question. Mayor Wu, thanks for staying with us through the break. I'd like to pick up on a range of things having to do with vulnerability and insecurity during these cold, cold winter months, Mayor Wu. We know more and more people are in need of heating assistance. They are behind on their bills. Where can city residents turn if they need help, especially on utilities? And do you have anything in the pipeline, additional plans around heating and energy insecurity during this cold winter?
Yeah, we've already had a couple of cold spells in the last couple of weeks. And what we've learned is that in some ways we need a revamp of how we think about meeting people where they're at with needs around extreme weather. The city's traditional model of when it's very, very cold, we'll open up warming centers, and when it's very hot, they're cooling centers. We actually haven't seen a lot of usage of those places. It's now less and less likely that someone will kind of leave their home or wherever they are and go to a location like a community center where there's guaranteed heat or air conditioning, depending on the weather.
Is that because of the pandemic, Mayor Wu? Is that what you think is going on there?
Even before the pandemic, you know, I've spent some time talking to our city departments. It seems like more and more people are looking to access services directly, individually, at their door. And so we do have more resources available. And no one should have to leave their home to be safe and secure during extreme weather anyway. And so I would say if you are interested in finding out more about the city's resources, you can always call 311 and get connected to our, whether it's the Mayor's Office of Housing, which has some resources, or if you are a senior in particular, we have a lot of resources available for our seniors when it comes to infrastructure and heating or cooling in your homes, and that you can access through the Age Strong Commission, but all of it you can get to through 311.
I want to talk a little bit about housing. A couple of things here. First, the number of homeless Boston Public School students has climbed by more than 25% in the last 4 years, according to the Boston Herald, nearly all of them students of color. What is the focus in the Boston Public Schools on addressing that? And I mean, what is broken, Mayor Wu, for that level of vulnerability that can be addressed now?
Yeah, we know that those numbers, as terrifying as they are also an undercount, right? There are far more families and young people who might not technically count as experiencing homelessness if they're couch surfing or sort of moving from relative to relative's homes. So the need is even greater than what we see, which is already great. In general, as our city's housing prices go up, as we are seeing housing insecurity and instability deepen with the pandemic, and as people are struggling to maintain jobs or find childcare, as different childcare centers have closed down because of the pandemic, all of that pressure ends up finding its way into our school communities. And so this is about our larger push to connect our young people and our school communities with every resource that the city has. Our Office of Housing Stability is doing amazing work, and they continue to try to individually, one by one.
Yeah, how does that work?
Residents with need.
Yeah, like, are there people in individual schools identifying the kid? How does that direct connection that you're talking about actually happen?
Here's another place where we really need to get in front of the problem. We know when our young people begin to experience homelessness because our schools find out that there's transportation needs, right? Now a family has to be connected from shelter, which is often much further away from the school than where they were before. But by then, it's already a very dire situation, and we can go in and provide housing, try to connect people with housing supports or job search supports. But there's already been tremendous trauma that young person has experienced. We're trying to move to a system where, through a children's cabinet, we can know a family situation before they get to that point of crisis. When they're just one rent payment away or 2 months of utility payments away from finding themselves in a much more dire housing situation, that's when we should be providing resources to prevent that from happening and make sure that that student, that young person, doesn't experience that trauma to begin with.
And how do you find that out? What does the Children's Cabinet do to give you that early warning system that we're missing now?
It's really about individualized connection to each one of our families. And so cities across the country that have implemented this successfully have a Children's Cabinet that is coordinating all of the services, even outside their school department, that families might need. And then they have a family navigator system where each individual family is connected to a point of contact that can help them with their needs outside of academics and what happens in schools as well.
All right, let's move on to transportation. And I'm going to pick up the Twitter sphere again here, Mayor Wu. At Z Wheels, Gary, and I'm Gary, I apologize for not pronouncing your last name correctly, Christopick says, will they try to prioritize walking, cycling, LEVs above traditional car infrastructure? Due to the climate crisis, we need greatly expanded bike paths to provide better options for the future. E-bikes are booming, including cargo bikes and enclosed bikes like the PEBL. Bike strategy for the city, and where does it fit into your larger transit strategy, Mayor Wu?
Yes, this is exactly what is in line with our Green New Deal and the overall goal of increasing the share of commuting from active transportation modes of cycling, walking, and making sure that we are and public transportation as well. We need to make all of these other options besides driving convenient, reliable, and safe. There is funding now, and hopefully we'll be seeing more funding from the federal government when it comes to green infrastructure and especially around electrification. So we will be hoping to tap into some of these resources for our citywide plan to ensure that we are creating connected, safe cycling infrastructure and networks, as well as improving the pedestrian experience and our Vision Zero plan citywide.
So the MBTA has made some changes to its fare structure, proposed them. The final vote will come in March. For example, a 7-day flex pass for the commuter rail. Critics have been concerned that their proposed changes do not offer a larger discounted rate for low-income individuals to expand that. What is your reaction to the latest move by the MBTA, and how is your relationship right now with General Manager Steve Poftak?
it's always good to see some progress. It's way past time that we have a low-income discounted fare for residents. I believe it was now over a year ago that the MBTA's Fiscal and Management Control Board, after tremendous advocacy from the public and from activists, the board itself voted through a low-income discounted fare. The state legislature voted in support of it as well, and then it was vetoed by the governor at one point a while ago. So we haven't ever gotten back to that in terms of being so close, and that is really one step in the direction of public transportation being a public good that we should all be able to get behind. Obviously, I would like to see it go even further, and we're working on fare-free public transportation and trying to pilot that on certain bus routes in Boston. But we see how much of a burden this can be. In the conversations that I had with residents of the encampments near Mass and Cass, as we were working with those residents to access permanent housing and to access treatment and recovery services, an issue that came up again and again as I was having conversations with folks in our engagement center was around how expensive transportation is and how to get from appointments or to access housing in different parts of the city that might be more affordable or available. It was a huge barrier to have to try to sneak onto buses or plea with the drivers to let them on because they couldn't afford the fares. And so this is an investment in all along our economic situation, our climate situation, and in terms of equity as well.
You just mentioned the former encampments at the area around Melnia Cass Boulevard and Mass Avenue. Earlier this month, the city moved those encampments out. And we have talked extensively here on Radio Boston both about the efforts by the city to put people in housing and claims by some who were in the encampments that housing was not available to them. As of today, do you know what percentage of people who went into a housing solution are still in that housing solution, and how many are unhoused at this time?
I will check with the team to get the updated numbers, but I have been out and speaking with folks either on our outreach teams or in the area around New Market and Mass Ave and Melnia Cass Boulevard a couple times a day for the last few weeks. And the reports from the ground are that many of the longer-term residents of the encampments remain housed in our low-threshold supportive housing that was created, more than 150 units that the City of Boston created across and the Boston Public Health Commission together created across the city. I visited the Roundhouse Hotel just to see what the conditions and the opportunities and setup was there, and it's amazing to understand the level of medical support and counseling and just in general staffing that is available to help people as they are working on recovery and housing and job search all together. So some of the folks that have been placed in the transitional housing have already moved on to permanent housing as well. And so those numbers will continue to change, and we will continue to see spots open up for others who need access to that transitional housing.
So what are the metrics you're tracking? Is it percentage of people who move into permanent housing? Is it whether or not there are a return of tents in the former encampment area? Is it how long people are in temporary housing? What is that number, Mayor Wu, that you're going to watch all the time that tells you that what you wanted to accomplish, you accomplished with that move?
Yeah, I mean, there's two issues here. One is the larger issue of homelessness in Boston and the progress that we need to continue making to tackle the root causes and to take on this very, very large issue. Another issue is also very large, but a more concentrated humanitarian crisis that we saw in the encampments at Mass and Cass, which represented all sorts of additional dangers for residents there, whether it was exposure to cold and hypothermia or unsanitary conditions, fires that were there because there was no heat and propane tanks were being used for heating. And so two of the metrics that you just mentioned get at making sure that we are making progress on both fronts. How are we able to stabilize people and connect them to permanent housing? And how are we able to ensure that we don't see a return of the dangers of that sort of crisis posed by encampments?
All right. Do you have time for one last question?
Yes.
Okay. So tomorrow we have Abigail Forster, a member of the search committee on the search for the next police commissioner for the city of Boston. What's the time frame that you are looking for that search to be completed? When are you hoping to be able to announce a new commissioner?
We are going to move as quickly as we can, but as thoroughly as we can. So there's no deadline because we need to get this right. The search committee hosted the first public listening session last week. The next one is this Wednesday. The session last week was incredibly helpful and just such a wide perspective of lived experience and advice and the type of feedback that we received. And so I look forward to digging into that more. We're also scheduling sessions for the search committee with individual stakeholder groups, such as some of our groups representing different configurations of police officers or community members. And after this initial feedback will be received, we're going to set parameters for what we're looking for in the search and then begin the process of officially recruiting candidates, sourcing them, interviewing, and vetting them. So I hope by the spring we will be in place to make an announcement.
Fantastic. That is Boston Mayor Michelle Wu. Mayor Wu, thanks for doing Monday with the Mayor. Hope to have you back again next month. Thanks so much.
Great. See you soon. Thanks, Luciana.
Maybe you've noticed it. So maybe it's the restaurant down the street, which is closed twice a week now, or reduced hours at the coffee shop you like to go to. Maybe you're covering extra shifts at your job, or you are attending Zoom goodbyes for coworkers as regularly as you are attending Zoom staff meetings. One way or another, we are all feeling the ripple effect of the so-called Great Resignation as workers continue the trend of leaving their jobs en masse. In November, the country set a new record for the highest number of quits in 1 month, 4.5 million people. So what is happening? Let's find out. And we invite you to join the conversation. Have you quit for a better job? Or has somebody you know or love? Have you retired early because you're done? Made a huge career switch in the middle of this pandemic? Or has some business that you care about been hit really hard by short staffing? You can call us 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK or tweet us at Radio Boston. Joining us now, Evan Horowitz, Executive Director at the Center for State Policy Analysis at Tufts University. Evan, welcome back.
Hey, Tiziana, I promise not to quit in the middle of this discussion.
I appreciate it.
I will do my best not to quit in the middle of this discussion.
I appreciate that, because then I'm just going to be making stuff up, Evan, and that's not going to work.
I mean, you could probably do all right. I think lots of businesses are discovering they have no choice but to do all right, but I'm sticking around.
I'm glad. So, but to that point, has the Great Resignation hit home for you in some way, affected your life or your work?
So I've been mostly insulated from it in an academic environment. You know, we've lost people. But it's, you know, the funny thing about my work experience is I haven't been in an office in a long time. I've been working from home, as I think a lot of people have. So even if there are personnel changes, I often don't even feel it. It's not part of my lived experience.
Because you can't see it.
I don't see it. I don't, you know, I go down the hall. There may be people who've left and I'll notice it when I, you know, return and I notice their offices are filled by someone else. But I don't see it daily.
All right. So what do we know, though, Evan? Who are the people who are leaving their jobs? And I think we have this perception that it's mainly retail and service or it's mainly people who are choosing early retirement. Give us that breakdown. Who is engaged in great resignations?
So, I mean, you've hit on some of the big populations. One is older workers who've decided to retire early. So there's a big group of people who at the onset of the pandemic thought maybe they would take a couple of weeks off or something and then realized that the world was not going back to normal anytime soon and decided this was it for their working lives and they're not coming back to work. So that's one side of the Great Resignation. And the other is workers who are looking around and saying, wow, there are really good jobs with really good wages everywhere, being offered everywhere. I'm going to quit the job I have now. I'm going to go get one of those. And that's been a real opportunity for lower wage workers, you know, in a variety of industries, not just the sort of customer facing industries like the ones you mentioned, but in warehousing, trucking, things, lots of places. People saying, oh, there's a great job. I'm going to leave mine. I'm going to go get that one.
So before I ask you my next question, you listeners, the descriptions Evan just gave, is that you? Did you do that? And if so, I'd like to hear. 1-800-423-8255. You said, I'm going to quit this one. That one's better. I'm taking it. It was early in the pandemic and you thought, okay, I could work for two more years, but I'm not going to. I'm done. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. So, Evan, do we have a sense of how much of this is upgrade versus I'm done?
So, we do have a sense, and upgrade is the big piece of it, the biggest piece of it, right? That even though we have a record number of quits, we even have an even larger number of hires. So that's the one we know. And that's not just true overall. It's true industry by industry. Wherever you look, there are a huge number of people quitting, and there is an even bigger number of people taking new jobs. So that does seem to be the biggest part of it, people upgrading.
And I assume, I'm realizing as you're speaking, Evan, that I make this assumption that there are costs associated in life with making these changes. So why are people so mobile right now? Is there lower friction, lower costs? Is it just that for the first time in a while, the demand for labor is so high that people are in a position to call their shots differently? Are we in a cultural moment where we're valuing work in a different way than we did before? What do we know?
So I think it's more the economics than the cultural moment. It's certainly true that remote work makes it easier to look for jobs in a broader variety of places. But this isn't a function really of remote workers. It's across the lower and higher skill workforce. So I don't think that's the driving factor. The big driving factor is in the U.S. labor market, the best way to get a raise, the best way to really dramatically improve your earnings is to change jobs. It's to say, listen, I can get more money somewhere else, either match it or I'm gone. And so when you're in a situation like this where there are lots of businesses looking for workers and not enough workers to do it, it's the optimal time to say, well, now I'm going to upgrade my salary. I'm going to go, I'm going to make more, I'm going to get a more secure position, whatever it is. I have a lot of authority, I have a lot of power, and I'm going to use it. And the reason you have a lot of power, as you say, the labor market is incredibly tight. People are buying stuff, but seniors left the workforce or a lot of people retired early. There's been a kind of dearth of immigration, so we don't have immigrants coming in to fill a lot of the positions that used to be filled by immigrant workers. So workers who are willing to work have their pick of the litter.
Okay, one more question, then I'm going to go to the phones. You just talked about older adults retiring. Some of that must come from the aging of the population, that we've got a boomer generation that is in that phase. But are we seeing a disproportionate rate of retirement among older adults compared to sort of the age cohort? Do you understand what I'm trying to ask?
Yes,
you?
Exactly. And we are. So the short answer is yes. This is over and above what you would expect from the fact that the population is getting older. These are people in their early 60s who, even by the previous trends, you would expect to still be in the workforce, who are not in the workforce. So yeah, it is distinct even from the broader question of, yeah, we're getting older, so there are more retirees. No. This is people of that age saying, nah, I'm done.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join this conversation. Tell us about your participation or lack thereof in the Great Resignation. We've got Ryan on the line in Somerville. Ryan, go ahead.
Hi, I just wanted to share my own experience that I was a partner working at a Big Four consulting firm here in the city, but was traveling often. And the other side of what happened with me with the Great Resignation is I saw how much I was missing being on the road and working at a job, 100 hours a week. Now, I was making a lot of money, and my whole career I kind of justified the money for the lifestyle. But getting off the road and just being more home with my kids and my family showed me that I didn't quite need that same lifestyle and could be a lot happier, and have now found a job off the road making less. But I joked with someone recently, I make half as much, but I'm more than twice as happy.
Hey, thanks for that call, Ryan. I appreciate you sharing your story. I'm going to grab one more call here for now, 1-800-423-8255, to tell us your story. We've got Evan on the line in Jamaica Plain. Other Evan, go ahead. Evan, do we still have you? Okay, so I'll come back to Evan Horowitz, our guest right now. Evan, I'm thinking about what Ryan just said and a Sloan report that I read in preparation for today, talking about the fact that in some of the highest areas of resignation, some are in service work and some are actually in areas like management consulting. So this is a blue-collar and a white-collar transition. What strikes me is this quality of life question that Ryan was bringing up. And I wonder, in the conversations that economists are having about this, are there predictions that we are going to see a fundamental shift in our culture of work in America? Or are we already seeing it? This is the tale.
What's funny is I think if we were already seeing it, economists would be the last people to recognize it because they have such a strong focus on the motivating impact of money. And, you know, in some sense, that's my read of the situation, is that Ryan's story, while powerful, and for sure there are lots of people in that situation who are saying, I want a better job. And by better, I don't mean more money. I mean more time with my family. I mean more flexibility. I mean all these other things. There are certainly people in that position, but the vast majority of the quitters are looking for more money and getting more money. I do think that's still the driving force. And I will say, I'm sorry not to have heard from the other Evan. I always like to hear from Evan.
Oh, well, I hear we got other Evan back, actually. So other Evan in Jamaica Plain. Go ahead.
Hi, yes, other Evan here. I just wanted to share, you know, I help run a nonprofit, and we've managed to retain our staff throughout these really difficult times, largely because we've instituted what we've called kind of a policy of radical flexibility. So recognizing that many of our employees have kids home from school or, you know, are taking care of a family member, or some of our employees have actually gotten sick for prolonged periods of time. And we've just had to kind of rethink our work, recognizing what the folks that work for us are actually able to do in this scenario.
So, Evan,
and I think just giving folks that flexibility has made a huge difference.
Yeah, so before I let you go, please give me one example, one specific example of a policy change in your organization that you think reflects radical flexibility.
Yeah, so we've actually made it, we're about to make it explicit in our handbook to say that folks have unlimited PTO as long as they check in and work it out. So paid time off. And then, you know, we just make it part of our workplace culture that in the morning, someone might say, I'm going to be out for most of the afternoon because my kids are home. And just making that okay and setting that as an example from leadership on down, you know, makes it not just on paper something that folks can do, but something that people actually feel comfortable and safe doing.
Thanks for that call, Evan, and the example. So Evan Horowitz, coming back to you now, Evan Horowitz, Executive Director at the Center for State Policy Analysis at Tufts University, for those who may have come in partway through this conversation. So there are some non-monetary examples that Evan in Jamaica Plain is giving us, and yet there's also a monetary dimension to that, especially unlimited paid time off. How do we find that intersection between the personal incentives and the financial incentives that you've been, you know, talking about here in this conversation as companies think about and employers, nonprofit organizations think about keeping people out of the great resignation and where they are?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great story also that Evan's telling, because I think it really speaks to the difficulty that nonprofits and businesses are having retaining workers. Right? What it says is we've got to do something dramatically different if we're going to keep these people. And it could be this policy like radical flexibility. If you can afford more wages, nonprofits very often are really struggle to increase wages. It could be higher wages, but they both speak to the same broader issue, which is workers have a lot of choices and businesses are going to have to do, they have to do something new, something different to keep their workers. And it's become an opportunity for a kind of flourishing of experiments among businesses and nonprofits. What are the things we can do, monetary and non-monetary, that will really allow us to retain our workers? So, you know, that Evan, other Evan, is trying something, right? They're experimenting. Maybe more paid time will work. Maybe more flexibility will work. But all of this experimentation is connected to the more basic issue, which is workers have a lot of power right now. This is a very unique labor market, and it's driving some pretty incredible changes.
So I'm going to bring in some data from the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics for Massachusetts and for the region. So 90,000 people quit their jobs in Massachusetts in October alone, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. At the same time, the Northeast has had the lowest quit rate out of the four regions in the U.S. So, for example, Northeast quit rate of 2.5% in November. In the South, it was 3.5%, a full percentage point higher. What do you think is going on there? And does the Northeast have a story about that that we are telling?
That's a fascinating question. I don't know the regional numbers. I could make something up, but it's probably worth saying something a little bit different, which is that these numbers that you're talking about, the quit rates and the fact that they're the highest we've ever seen, ever has a really kind of funny meaning here, because the data we have for this, both for regional stuff, what's the quit rate in Massachusetts, and for national stuff, what's the quit rate in the U.S., it only goes back to 2000. We don't have 100 years of data on this. We've got 20 years. And the last time we had a really good labor market was in the late 90s. We don't have data on the quits rate in the late 90s. So for questions like that, well, is this there a regional dimension to this and what might it be? How does this compare to other labor markets? In some sense, we're flying blind there. We don't know what the regional patterns looked like in the past in tight labor markets. And, you know, it would be interesting to try to figure it out, but actually we can't. So it's possible that what we're looking at now is unique to the post-pandemic situation.
So why
and
were
that any? Yeah.
Well, why weren't we tracking those numbers then, and why are we tracking those numbers now?
Oh, that survey just didn't exist. You know, the JOLTS survey just didn't exist before that time, and it does now. So we can track it, and it would have been great if we had. We were tracking unemployment. We've been tracking unemployment for 80 years. But yeah, the quits rate is a newer thing, as is the hires rate. And so it's hard to say how much of this is pandemic related, coming out of a pandemic. This is just unique. Or how much is a tight labor market? Maybe the quits rate was also this high in the late 90s. And anytime you have a tight labor market, you get this kind of worker power. And it's really hard to know which of these explanations is more accurate.
So for those who do like to sort of predict or prognosticate, I guess my next question then is, is it a sure bet that if this market were to flip again so that there was, a surplus of labor and not as high demand for employees, that this would stop, or is something extra going on? And I understand we don't know that it's pandemic, right? But it feels like there's something extra going on. And maybe that's just because it's the feels and it is not reality.
Well, it sounds like you and I could set up a bet here, because I don't have the feels and you do. And that's a good, that's a good basis for a bet.
I love it.
But yeah, because my sense is no, if the fundamental dynamics shifted, that is, there were fewer workers per job, then yeah, these benefits would go away. The wage increases would go away. Inflation also might mitigate. But it would be totally different, and that would be the driving factor, not some kind of cultural extra that's been set off by the pandemic. But I could be wrong, and that's what makes bets interesting.
Yeah, so listeners, we will have to figure out what that bet is. I'm kind of craving pizza right now, so maybe we'll buy each other a pizza depending on who's right, and we'll have to figure out how to measure that. So my last question to you, Evan, what are you watching most intensely right now over these next few months on this?
So I'm really interested in the industry-by-industry breakdown. It has been pretty uniform across the labor market for a while, both high quits in virtually every industry and high hires. And I'm watching to see if that starts to shift. If suddenly there are some industries where quits get less common and hires get less common and others where it doesn't. I think we are sort of approaching a point where the labor market's going to start to normalize a little bit, and we'll probably see it in a kind of industry by industry, sector by sector way. So that's really where I'm focused.
All right. Evan Horowitz, Executive Director at the Center for State Policy Analysis at Tufts University. Evan, thanks so much.
No, thank you, Tiziana.
All right, listeners, we will follow up on this next Monday with a discussion on life coaching and career counseling for those who do want to make the big transition. We'll take your calls, so be sure to tune in. For now, that is our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening.